Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. This is your host, Isaac Rudansky, speaking. I am the founder and CEO of Adventure Media, one of New York's hottest growing performance agencies, and I am joined by the hip and otherwise by Patrick Gilbert, author of Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, now available on Amazon and everywhere books are sold, which is just on Amazon. Check it out. Get a copy. It's available in hardcover, Kindle, paperback, and it's a masterclass of digital advertising strategies for the modern age. We are also joined by the great Danielle Immerman, Adventure Media's very own content queen, and we're here to talk about topics related to digital marketing, business growth, career growth, and just whatever happens to be going on of note at the agency over the past few days. So earlier today, Patrick and I were talking, and we're both readers. I don't know if we're voracious readers, but we both like to read. We both pursue our interests through books on our spare time. Patrick has written a book, and Patrick was telling me that he was reading a book called High Performance Habits. I never read that book. And it got me thinking of a couple things. One is it sounds like a book that I ought to read. And then I was thinking about, well, I'm busy. I sort of consider myself somebody who has developed a bunch of habits that have helped me perform or helped me get through my day at least. And then I figured, why not talk about what Patrick has been learning and see if we could pick some things apart. So I guess my first question, Patrick, is why read a book like this? What's the purpose? When you saw this book on the shelf, what made you grab for it and say, ha, this is the book I should buy?
So I think before we even dive into that, I do want to push back a little bit because I don't think that you personally enjoy books like this. So this is, it's High Performance Habits by Brendan Burchard. It's sort of in like the Tony Robbins camp. And you and I have discussed this, that you've been an outward critic of these sorts of things. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds as to why.
More specifically, Tony Robbins.
Yeah, you're not a Tony Robbins fan. When you read nonfiction, it's much more on the, I want to learn a skill or I really want to like think a different way, right? This is a little bit different from that. And it is very cheesy in a lot of ways. And I think it's like, it's something that I don't totally enjoy or I'm proud of while I'm going through it. But this book has made a significant impact on me. And I think through a ripple effect to our agency, I actually first read it almost 2 years ago. And now have kind of been flipping back through it and rereading it. I think that's really good for something like this. But I think the reason that you read a book like this isn't necessarily for the actual lessons that the author writes about. More important than that is when you read something like this, you sort of start to daydream and you think about how the concepts are relevant to your own life. And I think this is kind of why these sorts of books made for great audiobooks and great podcast content, which is sort of why we're recording this. Because when you're listening to something that's a little bit more passive and you can sort of trail off and think about something that speaks out to you and why it's relevant. Now, we're going to go over these six high performance habits that are outlined in the book, but anyone can do that. Like you could look up a blog post and learn this, or you could just listen to this podcast, and I'll tell you what these are. And it's not going to be totally surprising. The real value that comes from something like this is by living with this author for a month or 2 months or however long it takes you to read this book, and by really holding yourself accountable and thinking about all the different things that come with it and sort of daydreaming a little bit. I think that's what I really enjoy here. It's sort of what I want people to get out of my book in some of the chapters, but that's kind of a separate point. So to get right to it, the six habits that we're going to cover here, they're a little bit more broad. If you've read The Power of Habit or Atomic Habit, there's a lot of books and content that have been written on the topic of habits. This to me is unique. Those other two books that I mentioned, Power of Habit and The Atomic Habit, they talk more about like individual unconscious routines that impact your life in either a positive or a negative way. They're not these unconscious things like eating a dessert every night or making your bed in the morning. It's much more broad than that. So to actually speak specifically about it, the six habits in order are seek clarity, to generate energy, to raise necessity, to increase productivity, develop influence, and demonstrate courage. So those are the six overall themes that Bruchard goes through in the book. Really what this does is it really forces you to develop a different way of thinking about all these topics. It's not like a list of here's what you should do in the morning when you get out of bed to be a better person. It's more of like, here's an overall theme and it can be unique to your situation to go out and tackle it. The main concept of all of this is self-awareness. And this is something that I think you and I would agree is very important, is probably the most important element, something we look for in prospective candidates about possessing a deep level of self-awareness. And with that, the author, Brendon Burchard, he has a website called the High Performance Indicator that you can go and take a self-assessment quiz, and it'll spit out your rankings on all of these six categories. I took this, I don't know, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I have my own like rankings, and I'll tell you what I didn't score well in and what I've been working on. It's probably not going to be a surprise to you, Isaac, but I think it'll be useful.
Could you just tell us now?
No. You'll have to listen. So that's the self-awareness piece. The second is that all of this is reliant on being a genuine person and really comes down to wanting and having a natural desire to care about other people and to try and influence those around you in a positive way. If any of this is rooted in trying to manipulate others and, you know, like kind of game your way to the top, none of this is going to work. Isaac, do you have any thoughts on any of the content we've covered so far?
These are all very interesting topics. You talked about clarity and energy and influence and productivity and courage, necessity. These are all words. I'm interested in this clarity element for a moment. It happens to be the first topic in the book, but I'll tell you why it's interesting to me, because it's different. When you talk about high performance habits, if I were to poll 100 people and say, list words that you think about when you talk about high performance habits, I would guarantee clarity will not be one of the top ranking words. It sounds interesting to me. So what does he say about clarity?
Right. Yes, it's a personal type of attribute. So the idea of clarity is figuring out and being totally self-honest and self-aware about what is most important. So there's kind of four characteristics of it. So the first is with yourself. So it's really knowing what you want to become. The second is a social element. So being aware and intentional around like what your interactions are with other people and having an actual clear mindset about what you want to get out of your social interactions. The third is skills related. So what sort of skills do you need to develop to accomplish whatever your goals are? And the fourth is an overall level of kind of like goodwill and service. So in general, being clear about how your actions impact others. So all of these kind of roll up to that self-awareness theme. If I were to speak from personal experience, this book was the catalyst that resulted in me writing Join or Die. I listened to the audiobook first before I actually bought a hardcover. And I remember even exactly where I was on the Meadowbrook Parkway, driving to the office one day when it was covering this like first chapter and challenging the reader to think about what is most important and what are the skills that you need to develop to do that. And I just decided to myself, the most important thing that I need to do for my career and our agency is to write the Join or Die book. So I think that's kind of the best example I have. And part of that, though, is at that time, I wasn't the kind of person that can pull it off. I needed to be very self-aware of my strengths and weaknesses and figure out what I need to do to my life to be able to become the kind of person that can pull off that goal.
It sounds, though, difficult, because he's saying you need to develop clarity in a bunch of different dimensions, like clarity on what skills you're missing, clarity on what's the most important thing to you. But I think a lot of the reason why people don't have clarity is because they don't have clarity, because they don't know. How do you do that? How does somebody, if the reason for someone's lack of clarity is the symptom itself, you're stuck in a circle and you need a way out. Or is the reason that somebody doesn't have clarity because they've never stopped to actually think about it? Is it like a meditative experience? Can I get help from somebody else? Can I unlock some hidden chamber of my soul or my mind that will make things clear to me that weren't clear to me before? Am I not clear because I've convinced myself that getting clarity could be potentially very daunting and very uncomfortable?
I think all of us have the ability to gain clarity. And again, you're not just going to have a light bulb that goes off in the middle of thinking about this, and you're going to understand, you're not going to figure out all the answers. But I think it, to your point, it is sort of meditative in a way. You know, people that practice meditation don't necessarily unlock the meaning of life, but it's these small milestones throughout the way. And this is something I was going to come back to toward the end, but I guess I'll discuss it now because you bring up a really good point. I think what this entire concept does, whether it's see clarity or any of their habits, it really just helps you think differently, how to prioritize your work, and really develop a mental presence so that you can tackle problems in your career, in your life, with more of a rational and logical mindset that is driven more by rationale and less by emotions like fear or embarrassment or stress or anger. So the idea of clarity is really just being brutally aware of saying, like, okay, well, what is the most important thing that you need to do? And a lot of times people are that's when the excuses start. So if you start with this first concept, and I think a lot of these other habits, as we discuss them, once you kind of go through the cycle here, you come back to the, okay, well, that's not a valid excuse, or, okay, well, you can overcome that by developing this skill. But I think that first step of being self-aware and kind of recognizing your own strengths and weaknesses and figuring out where you actually want to be is probably, I think everyone can achieve that in some way.
Let's draw it down to like a practical example, right? Say this is something which is probably pretty relatable to most people. Your daily task list, daily prioritization. Whether you're a junior member of a team or you're a CEO, there's a lot of things you likely want or need to get done throughout the day. And it's most likely that you are somebody who is not getting all those things that you want or need to get done throughout the day, during the day. So you hear a lot about time management and time management software and pausing your inbox. But I think I would dive into this idea of clarity a little bit, this concept of clearness, clarity, as a means to positively impact time management and prioritization.
I would say let's hold that thought. Let's circle back to that. That's more relevant to something else we'll discuss in a minute, like maybe two or three steps down the road.
Okay.
Let's go to the second habit then, right? So the second habit here is this concept of generating energy. Anyone you know that you would think of as a high performer, I would imagine that you don't also associate them with a low level of energy. This is not rocket science. This is actually one of the three key attributes that we look for when hiring is their energy level. Again, there's a chapter in Join or Die that I mentioned this. Energy is two things. You have physical energy. You hear a lot of CEOs that have very, very regimented exercise routines and dieting. There's very few successful people that are complete slobs all the time. So physical energy. The second would be mental energy, which is sort of creating a positive outlook, staying in a good mood. And there's a lot of different ways that's not something you can just kind of talk yourself into. The author talks about this concept of mastering transitions in life, which is something that to me has been extremely beneficial. It's not just transitioning from one meeting to the next or one task to the next. If you really look at your day, there's a lot of different things that you transition from. The simple act of going from your commute, when you leave your car and shut the car door, to when you walk into the office in the morning, that is a transition where you're going from your solitary time, where it's just kind of your free time, you're doing whatever, to when you're actually in an office environment working with other people, representing other things, you have to be on your A game. Now, if you just simply take a split second and recognize that transition, it can really do wonders for you. Now, this is one of those things that like sounds great in theory, but in terms of generating energy, and this is something that I found personally really helpful. Myself, I think you as well, have suffered from burnout every once in a while. And I think if I'm trying to be very aware of what leads to burnout, it's when I'm just constantly going from one thing to the next, like a robot, and just droning on and on and on. Being remote and working remote is like the worst case scenario for this, because it's not even like I'm going from the conference room back to my desk over to here to there. I'm just staring at the same screen all day, clicking boxes and looking at all my colleagues in different little Zoom boxes. That generates burnout because there's no actual transition. It's just all the same thing. If you do take a second and you just kind of think, okay, well, now I'm going, you look at the time, you remember what day it is, and you really try and ground yourself in that moment, it does help you bring more energy to the next thing that you're trying to do. A quote from the book that kind of stuck out. He says, "The simple act of deliberately pausing between activities and setting intentions will help you gain more presence in your life. And that's something that I think is really important. And I try to do, particularly when I'm going into a meeting that I need to be on for.
There's a lot of interesting research, and I have to read more about it. You're really tapping into mindfulness and the mindfulness movement. It's a huge movement. And, you know, it's life-changing. And one of the key elements of mindfulness is taking a moment to be present, right? So, like, which is what he's describing. And I've practiced this. It doesn't always work. And I know, and I have a very, is a really cool thing, because you know if it works. You know if it works if you remember
to do it.
No. Well, yeah, that's one, you have to remember to do it. But then you do it and you're not sure if it worked. But if you remember later and the day after, the week after, this moment of mindfulness, you know that your mindfulness exercise worked. Mm-hmm. And I'm not an expert, but you have to, well, maybe I'll try to do some reading on this. You pause. Part of it is you close your eyes. You allow your senses to be activated. Listen to the sounds of interesting things that you don't really listen for before. Maybe you pick up on the wind rustling the leaves. You pick up on somebody walking down the street and their boots crunching snow. Then you pick up smells. Like maybe there's a subtle smell of something that you wouldn't have otherwise been aware of. You pick up the sound of voices. And then you pick up rich textures and voices. And then you open your eyes. You look at the scene in front of you. And you also, you let your mind wander. And I remember doing this once where, like, my mind was just picking up the color of a fire hydrant. And my initial reaction is, well, I should look for something more meaningful than the color of the fire hydrant. It's the thing that dogs piss on. Like, why is that the thing that I am most interested in? You know, but like, you have to not judge yourself in mindfulness. It's just, you're sitting in the moment and you're just imbibing all the things that your mind and your instincts wander to. And I remember this from so long ago. Like, I remember where I was. I remember the weather outside. I remember the moment. I do this sometimes with the kids, because, like, I feel time just flies by, and all of a sudden your kids are born and now they're 5 years old. And there's certain stages of life where, like, they're really cute. And it's a little stage of life where the kids are pleasant. It's very small passage of time. And you want to try to be mindful in those moments of pleasure, because there's few of them.
I hope that the average listener understands your sarcasm in that. I certainly do, but that could come off in a really negative way.
Or if the listeners are parents, they'll understand how unsarcastic I'm being. My daughter was just like smiling, and like you try to stop for just even for 5 seconds, and you like take, it's almost like a snapshot, but you have to not force it. I remember one time I was in Vail on a ski vacation, and I was thinking to myself, like, I take these beautiful vacations once a year. I love skiing. I love being outside, but I don't remember it. I have this vivid, vivid recollection in my mind from like 2 or 3 years ago. I was at Mid-Vail Mountain. It was our last day of the trip, where there's like a nice lodge in the middle of the mountain. I was drinking a coffee. My ski boots were unbuckled. I was smoking a cigarette. And I was just like looking out at the winter wonderland. I was just enjoying, appreciating life. There's so little time, and I'm talking personally, I spend taking a break, even if it's 10 seconds long, and just saying, you know, this is nice. This is very nice.
That's a Kurt Vonnegut thing. He tells a story of his uncle that was sitting under an apple tree drinking lemonade or something. And he smiled and said, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. And in his final memoirs, he encourages people to think of that as much as possible, to sit back and look at whatever you're dealing with, whether it's you're on vacation in a beautiful landscape or you're with your family or whatever, and to take a moment and say, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is.
Right. And like in that moment, it was that mindfulness moment was meaningful to me, because it's more than just taking a picture and remembering the picture, because this is your mind and your being is recognizing something good and something pleasant. And that has some sort of chemical reaction in your psychological orientation, your emotional orientation, that looking at a picture of an event will not have. And it's the same thing in business. Like sometimes I try here and there when I can remember, like on a particularly stressful day, and maybe it's a good idea to practice during a transition period, like Bouchard is saying. You have some time to do it. It's a convenient time to do it between activities. Or sometimes if I'm having a really hard or really stressful day and the things just seem bad, I try to just like sit down, I close my eyes, I look around. I was like, listen, this is nice. There's chaos, but there's good people around me and there's good things on the horizon and I'm healthy. People around me that I care about are healthy and there's stress and there's tragedy and there's trauma. Like, you just be mindful for a moment. And sometimes you don't need to think that far. Sometimes you just sit, let your mind clear. You listen to the sounds coming from the street. You listen to the wind, the elements, go for a little walk. And it does a lot. And I think that this idea of capturing a few moments of presence or mindfulness during a transition is interesting. Just think for your well-being. I found it when I've like been able to do that, it's interesting and it's been helpful.
I agree. So the principle here is the idea of generating energy, and there's physical energy, which really shouldn't be ignored, but I feel like enough people talk about it that we all know that it's important to exercise and eat right. It's honestly something that I've tried to take more seriously over the last couple of years. And I do think it makes an impact. Sleep is very important. But then kind of everything we talked about over the last couple of minutes is really about the mental energy and creating a condition where not only do you have this clear, positive headspace, but also a positive mood, which can kind of radiate to those around you. So I want to move to the third habit that's discussed in the book, which is raise necessity. This is one I care a lot about. This is one I talk a lot about with our team. It's just creating internal and external motivations. And whether you have that intrinsically or creating an environment where those things can exist. So if you take two runners about to start a race, and the first one is thinking before the race, I want to win this because I want to experience glory and I want to be the victor. Great. Second runner is saying, I'm doing this to honor my mother. I think we would bet all things equal on the second runner winning the race, just because there's this external motivation that's going to drive them to push them a little bit harder. And again, that's kind of like a weird, like sort of fictional example. But I really do think that this concept of raising the stakes internally and externally is something that everyone could really benefit from and should be thinking more about. The research that Burchard mentions in the book proves that external motivation will have a greater impact than individual internal motivations, all things equal. But it starts, obviously, with setting a high standard for yourself. Like, if you don't hold yourself to a high standard, then none of this is going to work to begin with. So that's kind of step one. That's kind of putting the bar at a certain level. But then that second is finding whatever that motivational factor is. One thing that I've found is certainly helpful is talking about your goals with other people that can then hold you accountable. So when I set out to write this book, I came to you and I told you about it. And this is something I think I've actually covered on a previous episode. But it really made a big difference. Like, because all of a sudden I went to my boss and said, hey, look, this is what I'm going to do. It's going to be a long-term project.
This is cheating a little bit. I want to grill you on the harder part. Because, sure, if somebody holds themselves accountable and somebody has intrinsic sense of responsibility, which is a unique characteristic, then there's lots of mechanisms. You know, tell people, make yourself a star chart, tell yourself. Telling other people is just another gradation of telling yourself to the person who is worried about integrity of my word and my commitment and my responsibility. Like, I think I struggle with this, but to certain extents, if I tell somebody I'm going to get it done, I get it done. Like, I care. I think I care more about, like, I just don't want to be looked at as a person who can't deliver. So I will go to hell and back to get it done if I say I'm going to deliver. But then there are times where I've set goals for myself, whether it be exercise or weight loss or healthier habits. And that's like, I have a month of motivation and there's no need to like go on about that because I think everyone is like that by default. It's difficult. So let's talk about the person who doesn't yet have a developed sense of internal responsibility. If he sets goals, he cannot keep them. If he tells people he's going to quit smoking or learn how to play guitar, that's not going to matter because he doesn't really care. But such a person wants to change. He wants to be the guy or the girl who sets a goal and that goal matters. Or he tells a friend that I'm going to accomplish, or I'm going to stop drinking, or I'm going to build my first piece of custom furniture, or I'm going to launch my first Shopify store. And the fact that he told a friend matters. Well, so what do you tell that person? What are some mechanisms for that person to develop a sense of internal responsibility for which intrinsic and both extrinsic motivations can have an impact.
It's a fair point. I personally believe that anyone in our close network, probably anyone that's listening to this, anyone that we generally interact on a day-to-day basis, anyone that reads this book probably has some sort of high standard for themselves already, which is why I probably haven't spent as much time thinking about this to begin with. But yeah, it comes down to setting goals about what your future identity looks like. And then I think that that's kind of the reason that working through these habits in the way that they are is because you kind of get to the end and then you work backwards. So then it kind of rolls back to the energy and the good mood. And then it goes back to the seek clarity. Like, what do you want to achieve? Okay, cool. Well, if you want to be a professional athlete, then you have to be able to do these certain things. And ultimately, you need to be the one that drags your ass out of bed every morning at 5 o'clock in the morning to go work out. That's kind of just like the baseline. I don't think I'm the expert on talking about these things at length or in a different way. I don't think I have a unique perspective on it, just because I think myself and those around me, you, Danielle, everyone else that we talked to on this topic just kind of has that innately. Maybe that's an excuse for me not having a better answer to this question, but I do believe that.
I think it's along those lines. I think it's about going back to clarity. It's thinking about your impact on others and the type of person you want to be long term. You could look at it in many different lights, but let's say children is one. What kind of role model do you want to be for your children? Like, that could be a very motivating force for a person to start taking themselves more seriously, for a person to start taking goals that they set more seriously.
Right. And I think that's, Bruchard kind of mentions in this topic that on the idea of raising necessity, this is kind of when you start to look outward and really have to reflect on what your success benefits, not just yourself, but others as well. And that's where you can draw that extrinsic motivation. Like, let's go back to the book example. I don't have a starving family that was going to live or die whether or not I published a book. Like, a lot of people are in that situation, whether it's a book or something else, where it's like, I need to do XYZ thing, not for myself, or maybe it is for myself, but I also have a family to feed. And that is going to be, if I fail at this, then I'm going to fail them. And that's what's going to push me through. This specific goal that I had in my life, the stakes weren't naturally that high out of the gate. So I needed to create those types of things. And that's where I think this is much more valuable for people to think about, because, again, more people listening to this, I think, have that first step where they're naturally motivated internally, but probably need to look around them and raise the stakes externally. And the simple act of telling somebody what your goals are, and then, but somebody you trust will hold you accountable, is one of the most impactful things. One of the best pieces of advice that I can give others, to the point that I have colleagues in our agency that have set up these sorts of mechanisms with me, not my subordinates, like not somebody that like answers to me, a true colleague, a peer that has come to me and said, hey, look, I want to work on this thing over the next year. Can you hold me accountable? Let's have a meeting every other week where I'm going to check in with you. And this has happened. This has happened over the last year where one of my colleagues has come to me once every 2 weeks and we meet and we discuss it. And I say, okay, great. What are your goals over the next 2 weeks? And they explain what it is. And then I hold them accountable. And if they don't, I kind of shove it back in their face. So you need to create these sort of mechanisms in your life where people are going to be able to hold you accountable in a way that you can essentially turn around and say, I can't fail for them.
Okay, this ends part one of High Performance Habits. We went through a few interesting ones and we're going to continue on the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. And of course, I have to ask, Patrick, where is the best place to hide?
Second page of Google.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you in the next episode.